What happens in our brain when we fall in love? How does love work?
It's not a moment. It's a process. I mean, obviously, we have the Hollywood version where it's a momentary blip, and it's a tremendous. We imagine a tremendous surge of dopamine and oxytocin and all these chemicals, and that is not the case. Love is absolutely. It's a long process. It's the attachment process. I mean, attachment is the evolved mechanism for it. And you see this obviously not just in humans, but across the animal kingdom. And there are all sorts of reasons for attachment. But that's the very short answer is what happens when we fall in love. It's not a happening. It's a continual process and takes endless amounts of work and effort. And it's something we have to keep doing. You have to keep falling in love, so to speak.
Mm. Do you think it's like a muscle? So if we don't work on it every day with our loved ones, it can atrophy away and we can get worse at it?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely like a muscle. I mean, the metaphor I always liked, which is a bit technical, but that we have a working model of love. And that's what I loved about attachment theory and why I wanted to write a book about it is the way it connects us across the lifespan. So your working model of attachment is developed at a very young age.
Yeah.
And it's largely based on your parents, but your caregiver, someone who you form an attachment to. And that's because humans are useless for an extraordinarily long period of time. So we're dependent, we're parasitic on someone else to take care of us and keep us alive. And so you form an attachment to them. And it's part of this very profound relationship that gives us this working model of love. And people have shown that obviously the working model of attachment you have, the muscle, so to speak, that you develop as an infant shapes your relationships to your loved ones, to your partner, to your own children as you get older in middle age and throughout the lifespan. So it is this burden that we carry for our entire lives. And I think just that idea helps explain so much of
human
experience, right? I mean, I always love the notion that humans are experience rich and theory poor. And what I love about attachment theory is it's a theory that even the broad brushstrokes explain so much of human experience.
Mm. Yeah, the internal working model is absolutely fascinating. And it explains so much about people around you. Like if you're growing up as a teenager and you are trying to fall in love and you're feeling anxious like I did, that it can help explain that. But it also can explain why the person you're trying to go after might be avoidant, doing the hot and cold tactics. And then once you learn that, you're like, wow, this is incredible. What attachment style do you think you were or are?
I was blessed to have amazing parents, grew up with a secure attachment style. Doesn't mean we still don't have our own frailties and neuroses. I think one of the fascinating things about middle age and becoming a parent yourself is you still find yourself recapitulating all these things that you experienced and suffered as a child. That is the human condition. What's that Philip Larkin line about how your parents fuck you up? The continual discovery of middle age is like learning all the different ways you kind of relive the imagined sins of your parents. I think all we can hope to do is be a little self-aware of this process. And
yeah,
I think that's another thing I love about attachment theory. Bowlby and Ainsworth and all these geniuses of social psychology who gave us this framework. It's not a solution, right? Like all great psychological theories, it doesn't really tell you, it doesn't cure your life. It doesn't fix your problems. It just gives you tools for self-reflection. Which hopefully you can put to work so you don't recapitulate all of your parents' mistakes.
Is there actually a world where you can be a perfect parent, have a perfect childhood, or is that just too hard by a bar? And does the mistakes of our parents just reflect the reality of life in general and therefore actually can be a benefit because it can prepare us for life? Whereas if we were coddled too much or our childhood was too perfect, then we might not be able to perform as well in the real world when challenges do arise. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, certainly I think the notion of being a perfect parent is absurd.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when my first child was born, the very first thing I did in the delivery room was put her diaper on backwards. And the nurse very, very kindly tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Dad, I think you're putting me on backwards." So that's how long friction lasted, about 7 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just that the notion of perfection, of course, for any human being is absurd, but I'm not even sure it's desired for all sorts of reasons. One, I think part of it's impossible to separate the act of love from the work of love, right? So one of the reasons I think we love our children so much is because there's so much work, is because there's such pains in the asses. It is the changing of the diapers. It is the 3 a.m. wake ups, but that is also why you love them, right? The burden of childcare is inseparable, I think, from its blessings. And there's no shortcut around that. I think your larger question, is there a problem with having too easy a childhood? Absolutely. I mean, you know, I love the work of Angela Duckworth on grit. And I think one of the takeaways for me of grit at a high level, regardless of the kind of the empirical details, is just grit is a skill we develop. And if things come very easily to you, you know, the prodigal child who finds school easy, who always gets straight A's, I think the downside of that is you do end up in a world where things will be hard, right? The whole point of doing anything good is that it's going to be hard. I love the line about creativity, that the only way to be creative is to systematically underestimate the difficulty of the creative act. Because if you knew how hard it was to write a book or have a podcast or make a movie or be a great photographer, you would have given up a long time ago. It's only because you underestimate how hard it is that you do it. So if everything comes really easily to you, I think you never build up those muscles, the grit muscles. You never learn how to be gritty and persevere. I think difficulty becomes a form of feedback telling you, oh, I'm not good at this, I shouldn't do this. When reality, the difficulty is just telling you, keep going. If this is what you love, keep going. But so I do worry about that more generally. If things come easy to us, and we now live in a world in which a lot of stuff is engineered to make it easy, we kind of never learn the necessity of perseverance. So, I mean, that's kind of a riff on the larger trade-off of you know, ease in general, why it's good to struggle and fail and so forth.
Yeah. And it says a lot about our society that we have dedicated rooms that have plates of metal in for people to lift, because day-to-day lives don't actually, you know, enable us to do that unless you're working a labor job, which fewer and fewer people are working in every single decade. So it goes to show that grit is still needed. Doing hard things is still needed. And it's the same as, I'm going to use the sauna as an example. I always use it. But like, you're just sitting in a room that's very, very hot, and you're just trying to see how long you can last in there. And I tend to do both of those things, going to the gym and going to the sauna every single day. And you get such a boost of endorphins, these almost endogenous opiates almost, in a way, when you get rewarded so much. What do you know the reasons behind that? Why, when we do these hard things, we actually get rewarded? Do you know the evolutionary reasons or potential reasons for that?
Well, I mean, I'm sure there are endless theories. I personally have not investigated that that in detail, but I think we're wired to do hard things because life is hard. I think it's as simple as that. And so life needs some way to give us, to mix in the pleasure with the pain. I mean, I would say, just reflecting on the phenomenology of my own experience, lifting metal discs and kind of sweating profusely on a bike going nowhere, it's not so much the pleasure, it's the release from anxiety. To me, it is, you know, as someone who sits in a chair all day staring at screens, it's like the release from that, just the pleasure of being back in my body.
Yes.
That to me is like, it's also bound up with the information age and staring at words. And it's something so primal about just like sweating from every pore in your body. that I get from running and biking nowhere and lifting meaningless weights.
Well, it's meaningless, and then you look 6 months later and you've been doing that meaningless thing, and then you've actually transformed your body and therefore got more confident and start to enjoy it even more. So it's a positive feedback loop, isn't it?
For sure, absolutely. And I do think, I mean, the psychological crossover, which I think about more in terms of running, is this notion of, I've always been interested in kind of what actually stops us. When you're running really hard, and I think every runner has this experience and any athlete has this experience, where you feel your body literally failing. So I used to run the 400 and 800 meters, and it's the last straightaway where you feel like you literally can't lift your legs. And the explanation was always lactic acid. It's lactic acid buildup in your muscles. Your muscles are literally failing, and that's why you can't do it. And that turns out to not be the explanation at all. Like the lactate thresholds are kind of so far removed. Our muscles are really sturdy mechanisms. What's actually happening is your brain, the central governor in your brain is what it's often called. That's not the technical neurological term. That's just what these exercise physiologists refer to it as. It's shutting down your body because it wants to preserve you. So it doesn't want you to die running this race. So it's telling your body to actually fail. And I think the notion of being able, so what great runners do is it's not, yes, they're peak physical specimens and yes, their hearts are built differently. And yes, their muscle fibers are built differently. But at a more fundamental level, what they're able to do is ignore their central governor, is push harder and say, I'm running a marathon. I'm not going to die. Don't worry. So kind of increase the threshold at which the central governor starts inhibiting the body. And I think that notion of pain tolerance more generally and being able to ignore your brain telling you to stop, telling you this is too hard, that to me is very much a crossover skill. And I wish there was extensive research kind of looking at kind of marathoners and world-class marathoners or world-class middle distance runners or world-class athletes in general and kind of in other domains looking at where the central governor may interfere and seeing does the skill carry over? Because I love that notion, which I think about a lot in terms of exercise, this idea that we blame our muscles and lactic acid. It sounds very definitive, as if it's out of our control, when in reality, it's just part of the unconscious, some primal reptilian part of the brainstem telling us, hey, stop, don't lift your legs, slow down, you know, don't die. But we're not going to die. Except to learn to ignore it.
Yeah, I think willpower as well is a muscle that you can train. And I did hear Andrew Huberman say something about willpower being in an area of your brain called, I think, the AMCC. And if it's bigger, then you have a higher tolerance to what you're talking about. And it's so interesting. And I didn't know that about the lactic acid. That's incredible. And I did the 800, 1,500. So yeah. I did not realize that.
Right? Yeah. I mean, if you start reading about lactic acid, you realize it is not the limiting factor. I mean, it does become at the extreme level, but we obviously evolved to run away from dangerous predators and our muscles don't give out that easily.
Yeah. And like you said about applying it to other fields of life, it does show that our brain is often the limiting factor to the goals and our success and the things we want to do. You know, we all have these limiting beliefs, like again, that we might have got from our parents unconsciously from childhood.
Yeah.
And how would you overcome those limiting beliefs, whether it's running or whether it's setting a goal that you think is too unrealistic? What are some behaviors or reframes we can try and do to overcome this and succeed?
I mean, if I had a good answer to that question, I'd be a more confident.
Yeah.
I love the little stuff they can do with world-class athletes to help them push the central governor is it's the placebo effect turns out to be really it's stuff like Tylenol can numb the body just enough so those somatic signals going to the brain are a little reduced and you can go harder. They're always looking at the margins to increase their performance by 1 or 2%. And the stuff that works for them is often, not obvious, but it is psychological. You know, I think when I think back on my own experience, it's very much being conscious of the translation from domain to domain. I think we tend to we tend to judge ourselves very harshly in specific domains and say, I suck at, you know, think about this with my kids all the time. I suck in math. I can't do math. And then you can say, well, you're really good at juggling a soccer ball. You know, and that took a lot of work, right? You got good at that, not because you were born good at juggling a soccer ball, but because you practiced endlessly in the backyard. Now, do you think math is different? So it's the generic, I think, Carol Dweck growth mindset attitude, which is this point such a cliche. It's, you know, it's at this point, it's a motivational poster, but I think philosophically it's still very interesting in reminding ourselves that when we judge ourselves very harshly in a specific domain, I'm really bad at this, reminding ourselves, but I'm really good at this domain and here are the skills and tactics and strategies that work in that domain. Why am I not applying it in this domain where I'm not good? It's more a mindset, I think. Of course, easier said than done. It's easier for me to give that advice as a parent than it is to live that out in my own life, but ain't that human condition.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, it's having that proof, even if it's in a different domain, that you've done something that you said you wanted to do. And even if it's juggling soccer ball, now you need to do math, you still have proof that you've done the hard work.
Exactly. And then to remind yourself, well, how did I get good at that?
Yeah.
And the answer is always going to be because I worked hard and devoted lots of time and love to it. And that brings it full circle to attachment theory, because the other wrinkle of attachment theory I love, which is that it's not just about love. It also, there's research showing it impacts your career relationships, the relationship you have with your work. So a secure attachment lets you put up with more struggle and strain and difficulty and failure, because you know that's part of the process. So if you love something, not just a person, not just a pet, not just another living thing, but an idea, a subject, to have that secure attachment working model lets you work harder.
So definitely. And what are the signs that someone does have a secure attachment? Because I'd say I'd have one, but then I remember when I was 15, I was a bit anxious, but I don't know if it's because I was going for the wrong kind of people. I just was a teenager and wasn't confident. But now I've had a girlfriend for almost 2 years and I feel really secure when I did some personal development. So how does someone know if they're avoidant, insecure, anxious, or secure attachment? What are some signs?
I mean, there are certainly questioners out there, and I think, you know, these are archetypes. I think it is important to note that we all have a blend. Anytime you try to divide human nature into discrete categories, we're all going to be a blend of them.
Yeah.
So it's our primary disposition, our primary orientation. And I think you explained it beautifully. I think if you're able to be in a relationship and you're not constantly worrying about, does this other person love me? If you don't find yourself pushing them away, then you're in a secure relationship. You are securely attached. And I think the test is always time, right? You know, I think the very definition of attachment is it's a process that is revealed over time. It's not an epiphany. It's not the act of, you know, falling in love as a metaphor. I don't like it all, because the act of falling is a singular thing. It's gravity. It's out of our control. And it gets back to that. It's not a moment. It's a process. So, you know, I think the test of secure attachment, of course, there are questionnaires on that, and you can think about your own childhood and reflect. And I think they're great tools for reflection. But I think the real test is, are you able to have a successful relationship? Are you able to have a number of successful relationships? Is that the primary feeling you have about your relationships, that your partner gives you comfort, that when you're stressed, when you're going through something difficult, are you able to make yourself vulnerable and turn towards them and get comfort from them? Those are all the hallmarks of a secure attachment.
And how would you find a secure attachment in a partner? I mean, when I first met my girlfriend, before we went on a date, the main question I wanted to ask, I didn't ask it straight away, obviously, but I wanted to ask her, like, what was your childhood like? What was your relationship with your parents like? Because I'd learned attachment theory. Is that a good question? What are some other questions? Wait, hold that thought. I'm genuinely so grateful that you've stuck around with us to listen to these fascinating insights from the guest so far. If this episode has given you one piece of knowledge which has helped you understand yourself and the world a little bit better than before, the absolute best way to support us is to pay it forward and hit the share button right now. Don't let this knowledge stay hidden. Please send it to one person who will benefit from this episode. Thank you so much. Let's dive back into the rest of the episode.
Sure. I think that's a great question. But like I said, I mean, the test is time. I mean, I think someone can give superficial answers.
And yes, that's true. Yeah.
You know, to me, the first test is when something difficult is happening to them or to yourself. Are you able to turn towards them? Are they able to comfort you? Are they able to sit with you in that time of difficulty? So it's this notion that love is revealed not in the cinematic first kiss, but love is revealed during that first really difficult moment of the relationship. And I think, you know, that is why time is the test, because life is difficult and you will have difficult moments. And that's why we invented love, to get us through those moments.
Do you think that's the evolutionary reason?
Well, I mean,
of love.
Yeah, probably at the most brute, primitive level, love was invented because we have to care for these useless babies for long periods of time. And they are lumps of need for like years. And then you got to pay for college. So, I mean, that is probably why love was invented, to care for offspring, and because you need to form monogamous pair bonds, because there's so much work. It takes two human beings to care for these lumps of need. So, I mean, if we're being very utilitarian, that's probably why love was invented. But we've since turned it into this capability that lets us do all sorts of difficult things. But at a fundamental level, I think love was invented not to make us happy, not to give us that, you know, dopaminergic surge, but to help us get through difficult things, to help us get through the hardest parts of life.
And this might be bro science, but I've heard that loneliness can be as bad for you as smoking and a lot of other negative things.
Oh yeah. 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 I think the dangers of loneliness at this point are very well established. I mean, you can look at the grand longitudinal study. So that's the famous study. George Valent is probably best associated with it, which followed 200 plus graduates of Harvard University post-World War II. And long story short, it found that markers of attachment were the best predictors of longevity and meaning in life and fulfillment, that wow, they far outweighed. And he's, I talk about this in a book about love, but he's the great source for this. His books are fantastic. It's one of the best longitudinal studies that are out there. And that's why A Book About Love really did try to focus on longitudinal studies, because, you know, the test is time. The impact of love, the benefits of love accrue over time. So the typical scientific experiment, which takes place on an afternoon in a sterile lab, that's not really going to teach us much about love. You really have to track people for decades. And that's where you see the true impact of attachment.
Yeah. And what were the likely outcomes of people who are or were lonely in these studies that you added into your book? What were the negative effects of being lonely?
I mean, so in the grand study, and I'd have to look back at the exact numbers, but if I remember correctly, loneliness was one of the biggest markers of a short lifespan. Wow. So these people who scored lowest on measures of attachment. The grand study began before attachment theory was really part of the psychological canon. But Valen later went back and tried to overlay and introduce questions of attachment to the study. And attachment was the great predictor. Valen has some incredibly romantic lines about how, in the end, what he's learned is that love is the presence or absence of love is the defining variable of life.
And is this mainly achieved through a long-term monogamous partner, long-term stable relationship with someone else? Or could this be through a lot of friends or family members?
Yeah.
What's the strongest one?
No, I think Valent became, I mean, don't forget, the study began mid-century America, where there was one type of love. Love was very strictly defined. It was a monogamous pair bond between a man and a woman. I think Valent definitely grew more expansive and Catholic in his definition of love, that you had men who just had lots of friends, men who had lots of different relationships, but found love in each of them. It was, and that's why I think his line became less about a definitive kind of love, like a 50-year long marriage, and more just the presence or absence of love. And I think there are people who can find that love in a passion, in painting, in an art, in photography, in writing, in a scientific pursuit. So I think, love is just it is falling for something. Typically is another living, breathing human being. But, I don't think it has to be defined just to that.
Mm. And how do you know if you're actually lonely? Do you know any of the signs or feelings that you can get? Is it always as obvious as people may realize, especially in the age of, cell phones and screens?
How to know if we're lonely? It's a great question. I'm sure there are endless scientific questionnaires that let us score ourselves on indices of loneliness. I think to me, it really is, to go back to the Valen quote, it's the absence of love. So to me, it's not like not having friends. I think that's obviously you're going to be lonely, but more specifically, it's like, do you not have something you love where when life gets shitty, when life is hard, when you need to be vulnerable, when you need someone to comfort you or something to comfort you, you've got some place to turn. And, to me, the most existential level, you're lonely if the answer to that is no.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And what actually inspired you to write a book about love? What was the main inspiration?
Oh, I mean, there were many. It was a difficult time in my own life where I was going through something very hard and I wanted to think about what was sustaining me, what held me together. And that's what led me to attachment theory. More broadly, I think attachment theory, it's certainly been celebrated and, I think has entered kind of the mainstream conversation, but it is one of those theories that, as I said earlier, explains so much of our experience. I wanted to give people the tools to kind of make sense of their own experience, because relationships, they're so full of particulars and moments and granular details that we often, it's very hard to track ourselves against the overall picture. And in the same way, talk therapy can be so valuable because it gives us narratives to kind of make sense of it all. Mm-hmm. I think attachment theory is one of those narratives. Helps you connect, which was the great goal of Freudian theory, was to connect your childhood experience to your adult experience, to connect us across a lifespan and reveal the coherence of the self. I think attachment theory is a more scientific framework for doing that.
Mm, yeah. And can we touch on the dark moments, the hard moments? What happened and how did you come through it? Can you run me through if you're comfortable?
Yeah. I was doing very well as a writer, had a best-selling book on creativity. And in that book, I made a very bad mistake. It's the great journalistic sin. I fabricated a quote, and I just fabricated a quote from Bob Dylan, one of my personal heroes. And, the origins of the mistake, I think at this point have been well established. I was racing to finish it. I put in a placeholder quote. Dylan had said something similar, but I never fixed the quote. Never went back to check. And that was symptomatic of kind of the larger process of how I tried to write that book, which was not full time while doing 10 other things, and wasn't careful, didn't fact check it, wasn't meticulous about getting everything right. And so I got a lot of stuff wrong. I think the Dylan quote was by far the biggest error, and was ashamed for it. Lost my job as a staff writer because of that. The original version of the book was taken off the shelves. We've since released corrected versions in many countries. So for me, it was obviously the shame of it all. the public shame, kind of to have a big failure like that in public. But even more than that, trying to grapple with my own private feelings, like how did that business happen? How did I care more about getting this book out there and being famous and being a public intellectual or whatever than about getting the actual quote right? To me, that is what I had to grapple with. And that took a long time through, and it was very, very difficult. It was very difficult kind of for my family to help through with my wife, like how I ended up making these kinds of mistakes. You know, that is what led me to think about, well, what is sustaining me here? All the stuff I thought I cared so much about, the fame, being on social media, you name it, that all went away. And so what did I still want? What still gave me meaning? And it kind of strips you bare.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you were exposed for it and, you know, you came out with the apology and I saw something on CNN, like it was really big. What was it like dealing with the online criticism? Did you get criticism in person as well? Was it as extreme as you expected it to be?
I mean, the online criticism, to be honest, wasn't the worst part of it. Not even close. I mean, you know, there is this notion of no matter what you say about me online, I'm thinking something worse about myself right now. So
yeah.
It's not that bad. I've thought something worse about myself in the last 5 minutes. So at a certain point, it does become noise. I think the harder part was getting over kind of the negative self-talk. To not think of yourself as such a piece of shit. Yeah. And that obviously is not something you do by yourself, right? That I was completely dependent on. And this again is what brought me to the subject of love. You're completely on the people around you and the people who love you to sit with you and tell you it's going to be okay. And, you know, I had to learn as a young man, like how to be vulnerable, how to tell people, here's what I'm feeling. Can you help me feel better? So, you know, again, these are all the themes we've been talking about, like the hard parts of life. So sometimes people ask me like, you know, your spin on love is awfully depressing. And I think that reflects very much my own perspective on it and why I came to the subject.
And how long were you in the darkness for? How long did it take you to get out of that period? And what was it like being fired? And how did you trace your next steps? How did you course correct? How did you figure out what to do off that point?
It was several years. I'm not sure there's an exact timeline. And it's part of my story. It's a shameful part of kind of my own narrative. The immediate way out, and again, this is, I think, part of the love book. The immediate way out was I had nothing to do, but I did have an 18-month-old child who I hadn't spent a lot of time with. That is one of the more shameful parts of the story, is that I'd been traveling, giving talks, blah, blah, blah. So I'd been traveling a lot and hadn't been a good parent. And all of a sudden I was home all the time with this 1.5-year-old. And that can be a difficult age, who all of a sudden was like, who are you and why are you always here? That was the immediate experience. And there was something extra humbling. And to me, when you asked about like the online, the public shaming aspect of it, you know, to me, that is very much intercut in a cinematic style with just this baby not wanting me, this toddler not wanting me around. Like, you know, she would fight she didn't want me to change her diaper. She wanted her mom to change her diaper. She didn't want her walk with me. She wanted her mom to push her stroller. Like, you name it, I was always second best for all the obvious reasons. So most days that was a lot harder. Being rebuked by my own child was much harder than what someone was saying on Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah. And Yeah. I mean, do you think you've been given a second chance in terms of your career aspects? I'm sure your child loves you now. So
you have an excellent relationship. Second chance. I'm incredibly fortunate that I still get to write books. At that time I was forced to step back and figure out, what do I love about this? There's that word again. What do I love about what I was trying to do? And at the most fundamental level, it was, I love the act of thinking through words. I love taking a big subject, whether it's love, whether it's mystery, whether it's creativity, and forcing myself to think through these big unknowns I sound like an LLM, through figuring out which word goes next. That is what I love to do. I love talking to people who are much smarter than me and asking them dumb questions and learning from them. That is what I love to do. And I'm still able to do that. So is that a second chance? I mean, I'm grateful I still get to do it. I'm so grateful I still get to do it. And the weird part is, now that I'm just doing that, I'm just getting to write slowly and carefully, and at a pace that feels sustainable to me, while still getting to spend lots of time with my family. I kind of love it more than ever. And for that, I'm very, very, very grateful.
Was it a blessing in disguise then? It seems that you've been able to course correct your life because of what happened. You know, you went to the bottom and then, you know, you reformed your relationship with your daughter and you've been able to write in a new way. Do you think it was a blessing in disguise in the long term?
I think that feels a little too trite for me. With all due respect, to call it a blessing, it was miserable. It was,
yeah.
And whatever kind of long-term benefits I got out from it in terms of perspective and, like, I inflicted a lot of pain on people I love. So to call it a blessing feels not fair. It was a big mistake. I made a really big mistake. I have done my best to learn from it. Failure is still failure. To quote Bob Dylan accurately, there's no success like failure, and failure is no success at all. I think that second part of the line, failure is no success at all. That is the lived part of my experience. So it's not a blessing in disguise. It was a failure I have done my best to learn from, but it's still a failure.
And what would your advice be to the person who's in rock bottom or is being cancelled or is going through a rough patch in their career? You know, I'm going to quote Bob Dylan, if you ain't got nothing to lose. What would you say to the person who's at rock bottom? What's your advice?
I mean, I hope you have someone you love and someone who loves you back. I hope you have something you love. Just get through it. It'll get better. You know, it is the one of the curses of pain, especially for someone who loves to think in words, is clichés are very powerful. And you find yourself in these low moments not turning to great poetry, but turning to cliches. It's those hallmark cards that get you through. And there's something very disappointing about that. You know, you want to be able to turn to your favorite works of poetry and get meaning from them. But you end up just, it's the mantras. It's very short staccato sentences. They're what are sustaining in those darkest moments. Or at least, I don't want to overgeneralize, I'm an N of one. They're what works for me.
Yeah. And can you explain, and this is really stupid, but can you explain this to me? You know, cliches, right? If they're so cliche, I feel like a lot of the time cliches tend to be things that everyone already knows, but they're not doing them. And that's why they're repeated so much. So surely they're not cliches if no one's doing them. It's almost like a paradox.
No, it's a great point. I mean, I think they're aspirations, right? They're maxims. They're things which we know to be true, which we can never quite accomplish. So they are What makes them cliches is their perpetual aspirations. Their impossibility is what makes them so meaningful.
Mm. And this reflects a bit onto human nature, really. Do you think everybody... we're going back to what we were saying about perfection. You know, yes, you made a mistake, but everybody makes mistakes. And isn't that a fundamental part of human nature? Shouldn't we embrace these mistakes and embrace failure? Do you think we have this dark side to us, or this just incompetent side to us that most people try and hide?
Yeah, I mean, to go back to cliches, I think we live in in the age of social media, and as a middle-aged person, to say the age of social media kind of like wince and be like, oh my God, it's not like an old person. But it's more like the age of self-portraiture. We're always putting out self-portraits into the world. What I love about Rembrandt, the reason he is my favorite artist, is his self-portraits. Some are very glamorous, right? He's got his pompadour, he's got his fur coat on. And some, it's the artist as an old man. Some, it's like painted his nose as it is with a wart on it. You know, it's like, when we go on Instagram, we're not doing Rembrandt self-portraits. We are doing the artist as a young man with a photo filter. Yes, I think it is harder to celebrate our failures because we're always putting the best version of ourselves out there. And there's something very sad about that. But there still is no shortcut, right? Like, we all make mistakes. To go back to George Valent and his work on kind of these Harvard men, as Valent loved to point out, these were the most privileged men in the wealthiest country in the history of the universe, right? They were Harvard men graduating post-World War II. These are the men you'd expect to have the easiest lives, right? They were all upper middle class, some extremely wealthy. And what he found is that no one had an easy life and difficulties. That is just the nature of life. So we are all going to fail. We're all going to make mistakes. Some will be more public and shameful than others. That's also the nature of the bell curve and human variation. But we're all going to make mistakes. The question is, I think, how do we deal? And that brings us back to love. Love is what helps you cope. Love is what gives you the meaning to persevere. But the notion that we expect somehow an easy life because that's what people on social media are living out, that's a fantasy.
Mm, very much so, very much so. And we're such social creatures. We love to signal our status, and that's why social media is so powerful, isn't it? And it can create unrealistic standards and expectations.
Yeah,
but I think it can also drive you as well. I think it can also drive you to improve your life because you see at least the good side of what you might be able to achieve, even though you should try and acknowledge there will be still struggle alongside that, right?
Yeah, but that's the nature of status, right? Jealousy, envy, they are powerful motivational forces. As long as we can somehow contain their corrosive downside.
Mm. And that's what I was going to ask, actually. You know, I think everyone to some degree has this yin and yang, this darkness in them, this dark energy, whether it's envy, jealousy, hate, spite. That seems to be a fundamental part of human nature. Where do you think that comes from? And how can we mitigate and manage it and not let it overcome us?
Oh God. For me, I can only speak to my own experience.
Yeah.
It's been very important to not try to fix it in my unlived life. Right. The life, if I had gotten that Dylan quote right, that took a lot of time, took a long time to be able to, and you know, again, all the cliches come out, be present, be mindful. They're all incredibly true and impossible. But what to me, if I had to reduce that down, because that's a very long answer. And the scientific answer, I'm sure, is about kind of social primates and status and alpha males. I'm not sure we ever escape that. It seems so embedded in the human condition. But for me, at a more tactical level, what's allowed me to be okay is to not live in this unlived version of my life, but to try to live as much as possible and be grateful. And again, gratitude, such a cliche, so important.
Mm-hmm.
To be grateful for my lived life, not the unlived one.
Mm. And it is interesting how envy seems to be hardwired, seems to be inbuilt and deeper in the brain. It may be in the limbic system. Whereas personally, gratitude seems to me more, is rational the right word, but maybe more in the neocortex. You have to actually consciously
be grateful.
It's
the Kahneman distinction, system one, system two. So system one is instinctive, automatic. Gratitude is entirely system two. It's entirely a journaling exercise for me, right? It's like, which is the definition of system two. It's like, got to set, I have to put in a reminder on my phone to spend 30 seconds writing a gratitude. It's embarrassing to talk about, but it's so useful.
Mm.
I'll stop.
Well, no, I'm the same. I have to put on my phone, read for 20 minutes, meditate for 20 minutes, journal for 20 minutes, or just forget and then have an app instead, which is still
beneficial.
But to
me, that's the definition of a system two task. If you have to put in a reminder to interrupt your day, you'll actually force yourself to do it.
Mm. And is that your best behavior to be more grateful, is to genuinely just sit down and journal?
Yeah. I mean, it gets even more embarrassing because I wish I had a paper journal. But I use the journal app on my phone, which I like because you can include pictures. I like spell check. I mean, it's so embarrassing, but I got to say, I love it. I mean, that is my favorite thing about my phone, is that journal app. I don't know if I'm the only one who uses it, but I love that thing. So I've got a prompt on my phone to journal every day in my journal app. I often include a photo from the day. It can be totally random. Here's a photo from soccer practice. My son did a good move. And then one or two lines of gratitude takes 2 to 3 minutes and I'm done. But I'm so jealous when Virginia Woolf's journals, to me, the greatest, an incredible literary document. And you see them as they're so wonderful. They actually came out with images of the longhand. And to me, that is what a journal is supposed to be, right? Mm. It's you see her working through ideas with insane eloquence, reflecting on her mental illness. I love the line, I feel my brain like a pear to see if it's ripe. It's full of this random lines like that, which are so pungent. And to me, that's a journal. And they're in my journal. And it's like an app on my phone. And I'm so full of self-loathing, but it's very useful for me.
Hmm. Different apparatus, same intended outcome though, right? Virginia Woolf's is very romantic. Yours is practical and less, frictionless, really. If you struggle to do it, which all of us do, then you want it to be as easy as possible. The fact that you're doing it is better than you not doing it, right?
I'd like to think we have similar outcomes. Love Virginia Woolf, one of my favorites. I don't aspire to the outcome of her life. But I like to think we get similar things from our journals. But,
yes, yes.
I also don't want to lie over the differences in quality.
But
for me, it's an important practice.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And what is it like being a father? What have you discovered about yourself in the process?
I mean, it's the ultimate vocation. I mean, it is, it's what I spend 99% of my, kind of waking anxieties. It is, someone running around with your heart is thinking about my children. That is, if when I think about my own story of redemption, and this is an embarrassing thing to talk about, it's not something, it is very much that I've tried to be the best father I can be. But they are glorious, and now they're all older, so they're just like incredibly interesting little people. And I mean, without getting too mushy, because no one wants to hear me talk about how much I love children. The one thing I will say is like, one thing I was not expecting at all is how much I've learned from them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even thinking like emotionally or, you know, kind of deep skills like that. It's just like at a superficial level, they all become interested in specific things. And then the pleasure is learning about what they're interested in. So, I mean, you know, to return to soccer at the top of mind, because we've talked about it a few times, like my son is a passionate soccer fan. I grew up not watching soccer at all. Now we're waking up at 4 a.m. to watch the Prem. You know, how did this happen? But it's your children introduce you to parts of the world you would never explore on your own. And to me, that is an incredible gift. So that is this particular phase of life I'm in right now. That is what I'm grateful for, is learning about parts of the world I would never have learned about because they're passionate about it. It's really fun.
Yeah. And now you've had kids, what do you think about the nature versus nurture? How much of you do you see in them, and how much is that, do you think, is influenced by the genetics versus the environment, and how do they differ compared to, obviously, their interests differ, like you just said?
I don't think about them in terms of nature versus nurture, that very discrete biological question. I think about it more in terms of meiosis and the random assortment of genes in the embryo. Because to me, when you have more than one child, you realize they're all so different. So to me, it has given me a new appreciation for kind of the way life creates diversity. You can take the same genes and the way they're randomly assorted during meiosis makes three very different human beings.
That's incredible.
The other thing I will say about kids is just, it's especially in this age where everything is changing so fast. They're very powerful tools for reflecting on how their childhood is different than my childhood, right? Because we're all very myopic about like, I grew up this way. Why grew up a different way? We should all grow
back
up
in my day.
I grew up. And like just one example, one thing I think about a lot in terms of their childhood is the absence of boredom. I mean, I think about boredom in my pre-smartphone childhood was a defining feature of life. Like you'd spend long stretches of your day, the summer, being bored. Even like you'd be bored watching TV because you didn't control what you were watching. Like
Yeah.
Boredom was a consistent theme of life. And to them, boredom is so aversive. They are so incapable of being bored. It's almost like, you know, like we need a power outage for them to understand what boredom might conceivably feel like. But then they still have their iPad, which has charge on it, and they can go to the library on their iPads. You know, it's like you have to work so hard for them to understand what boredom means. And that would be fine. But then here's, I think, to be a parent is also to have constant anxieties. It's like boredom, of course, is a very useful thing, right? Because boredom is aversive. No one likes being bored, but we're bored. Then the brain starts daydreaming. The mind starts to wander. And of course, there's lots of neuroscience on the default mode network and why the default mode network is so important. It connects far-reaching parts of the cortex. It's important for the formation of the self. It's important for social intelligence. I mean, we run through a lot of social counterfactuals when we're daydreaming. It's obviously a huge part of creativity. I'm thinking here of the work of Jonathan Schooler. So, I mean, here I'm just rambling, but it's like when you're a parent, you think about their childhood versus your childhood, and then you are constantly full of laments for what's wrong with their version of childhood. And the one that keeps coming up for me, and it's a recurring theme, my wife rolls her eyes when she hears me talking about the virtues of boredom. But it is, I don't think my children know how to be bored.
Yeah. I think I got lucky. I was on literally the tail end. It was like a few years of boredom. I can watch TV, but I couldn't control the channel. There were a lot of channels, don't get me wrong, but when you were talking about boredom, I had memories of just sitting in my room, just kind of staring at the wall.
Yeah.
But I can't think of any recently of being bored. Because when I'm sitting out, staring out the window on a train, I don't see it as boredom anymore because I'm so deprived of that behavior. I see it as something really positive and I'm not averse to it, which is quite interesting.
No, I mean, that I think is the dream. I think that's, it's hard for me. I mean, I think about these glorious gadgets we carry around in our pockets and we're often lamenting that they stole our focus, right? That we can't read Tolstoy because our phone is pinging us. I think what they've actually stolen is our boredom. They've stolen our dream. And I don't think we've really grappled with the consequences of that yet.
Could be dangerous.
I think in the grand arc of time, I think we will look back and say, human focus is always very limited and very bounded. But what they took away was the ability to be productively bored. And I think we talk about daydreaming a lot in terms of creativity, and that's a well-established part of the literature. But I'm more intrigued. My own sense of daydreaming, when I daydream, it's not so much a tool for solving my wicked problems. It's more a tool for thinking through social interactions. I spent a lot of time daydreaming about kind of social counterfactuals. If I'd done this, they'd have done this. And I think to the extent it's now clear that theory of mind is not an innate skill, but something we practice. And that's another part of attachment theory and all that. I wonder if we're going to see social consequences of kind of the fact that we've forgotten how to daydream. So daydreaming, when you do ping people when they're daydreaming, it's often kind of social imaginings. And we solve problems through that. I mean, one of my favorite stories of daydreaming is Virginia Woolf walking in Tavistock Square, daydreaming about her mother, and that's where To the Lighthouse comes from. Then she writes a letter to her sister Vanessa and says, I had this breakthrough walking around London, walking around Bloomsbury, thinking about mom, and I now know how to write my next novel.
Hmm. And think about Matt, all of those works that we're missing out on.
Yes, if she could have been playing Wordle, you know, she could have been walking around London, listening to this podcast, and we went up to the lighthouse. I have a feeling Wolf still would have found time to daydream, but so that's a very long-winded answer to parenting, but I think that's, your children do make you very aware of just how peculiar it is to grow up in this day and age. And obviously we're on the precipice of, with AI, with, we don't even know how weird it's going to get, but I think they make you very attuned to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And how powerful is solitude? Therefore, I've heard a quote, a lot of man's problems would be solved if he could or they could sit in a room alone with their thoughts for a long period of time. How true do you think that is from what we said about daydreaming and not being on your phone? And should we do what you've done with your journal and have it on our to-do list? Bored for 20 minutes, set a timer.
God forbid anyone adopts my online workflow. Solitude. Solitude and boredom are both, their defining fact is how aversive they are, how painful they are. I mean, I think of that, it's an experiment that got lots of attention a few years ago where you put people alone in a room, but give them the ability to shock their ankles so they can send a mild shock to their ankles. And I can't remember the exact details, but if memory serves, about 2/3 of men are more likely to do this, shock themselves repeatedly just because feeling something was better than being alone with their own thoughts.
Uh-huh.
And to me, there's something so existentially revealing about that experiment, you know, not just how much we despise solitude, but how much we despise solitude and boredom. But that explains why, you know, like, go to a public bathroom, you know, you go to and everyone, they can't pee. You go, maybe this is too vivid for a podcast, but you look down the row of urinals and everyone's got their phone out for 30 seconds. You're like, come on, guys. And then you get it.
Crazy.
clearly we're so allergic to solitude. Would it solve stuff if we're able to be alone with ourselves? I think there's absolutely a virtue in why we try to meditate, to learn how to be alone with yourself. I think it's an elite skill of human nature, and it is one of those cliches I certainly aspire to. I'm not good at myself. I mean, so like I had to, now I force myself to go running without, without buds in my ear, just because for me, it's a tolerable form of solitude. If I just force myself to meditate, that's like a bridge too far. I get anxious, but the act of running, being in my body, gives me just enough where I'm not fully alone. And I think that's part of the virtue of being a flaneur and walking in a city and daydreaming in a city, why I think that's kind of a uniquely productive way of being, because you're both alone, but not alone. Mm. There is some surface level distractions. You can watch the other pedestrians. You can watch the bus. You can look at the stores. You know, at the same time, your unconscious has enough bandwidth to ruminate and think. So to me, that's like, for someone like me who certainly doesn't know how to be alone with themselves very well, that is a more tolerable form of that.
Mm. I get the same with being in nature. I remember when I was like teenager, 15, 16, 17, 18, when I get away from school, I actually craved solitude. I quite like being in solitude, but like you said, in an environment that has those subtle distractions, and I've been obsessed with like animals and birds. So if I went out in nature, I'd be alone with my thoughts, but then, oh, look, there's a robin, there's a chaffinch, oh, there's a marsh harrier. And then I then couple that with my camera and then really focus on that one animal and take a photo of it. So it's kind of cheating a little bit, because you're not just sat there with your thoughts. You know,
that's absolutely what I love from a nature walk, or, you know, a hike or walking the city. It's like that kind of that punctuated equilibrium. So, it's not relentless solitude. It's very in punctuated bursts. So it's more tolerable.
Mm, yeah. And in terms of attachment and going full circle again, why do you think you struggle so much to just sit there alone? Where do you think that comes from?
Oh, that's probably a great subject for my therapist. I think part of it, this is going to sound like a cop-out, part of it's just my wiring. The act of making a to-do list is like one of my default modes.
Same, yeah.
Thinking, what do I have to do? How can I do it better? That relentless optimization that I often resent, but it's part of, at this point, it's part of who I am. So it does make meditation, for instance, very hard. I mean, I have tried, I'm really bad at it, and I end up more anxious. So to me, it's been like, okay, if I can meditate, how can I kind of get that sense of solitude? And that's why I love walking and hiking and running. Mm. That's my form. Oh, but where it comes from, I think beyond my wiring. I mean, now a lot of what I worry about, as I said, is my kids. It does expand with love, and I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. But as you love more and more things, and there was this sense, I remember one of my second, before my second child was born, like being very worried in a very silly way about, like, I don't have room in my heart. Like physically, I don't think I've got room to love something else as much as I love this other little person.
Hmm.
And of course you realize love is not a zero sum game. It's not fixed property. And it turns out your anxieties about the things you love, they expand in the same linear fashion.
Hmm. And that probably is hardwired, right? You know, I don't think we're hardwired to have our resting state as necessarily super energetic and happy and excited in terms of evolution, you know, because we would have had to look after our offspring, and we would be uncertain whether we'd get food tomorrow or whether that predator's round the corner. So it makes sense that we have to use, what system is it? Is it system one or two? Is it system two to consciously?
System two is the more rational mode. Yeah. And we have to use system two all the time to override the kind of the natural we have natural negativity bias.
Yeah.
Subscribe, right? Loss aversion is something I am very, very prone to. The idea that losses hurt more than gains feel good. Loss is a very pungent emotion. Pleasure is very fleeting. And again, pleasure is very fleeting for obvious evolutionary reasons, right? We are wired to be relentlessly greedy. Like, that hedonic treadmill is a real thing, because self-satisfaction, species dies out, right? You always need to want more and more and more. So we get such diminishing returns from all those pleasures while losses just sit with us. So it is, when you kind of zoom out and look at life from that perspective, you're like, oh my God, we're wired for misery, right? Pleasures are all fleeting. Losses hurt more and stick around. But, you know, we have to work on tools for getting around the fact that from an emotional perspective, the odds are stacked against us.
Yeah. And I try to define, I don't know if happiness would be the right definition for this, but at least contentment or happiness, I try to define as just the absence of negative emotion. I don't have to be feeling super energetic and, you know, joyful. But if I'm not feeling anxious, if I'm not feeling empty, I'm not feeling lethargic, and I'm just content, then I think I rationalize that as something positive. Do you think that's a good thing to do for those? Because I think there's so many self-help and happiness books and this dream that we should be optimizing for happiness. And I don't necessarily disagree with that. But at the same time, like we're saying, if we're hardwired for this zero-sum negativity bias, is it a bit unrealistic? And do you think we'll actually make ourselves more miserable trying to optimize for, again, the perfection, the happiness constantly?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a great point. I mean, my approach is generally I tend to discount kind of the moment by moment hedonic ratings, right? I mean, there is this paradox in the psychological literature of people with kids, if you ask them to give moment by moment readouts of their day, they don't like being with their kids. Childcare sucks, right? I just woke up at 3 a.m. I'm changing diapers. I'm doing long division math homework when I have five other things I'd rather be doing. So moment by moment, it's not great. Like, it's, if memory serves, just below cleaning the house. And yet we all have children, and then we love them so much, and they give us such sources of meaning. So I tend to think about this more kind of, and Viktor Frankl, who, again, you know, maybe cliche, been very meaningful to me. He talks a lot about kind of privileging meaning over those hedonic moment by moment ratings of life. Like, life is long. The test is time. And trying to focus more on the meaning we get from it than like, how was my afternoon on a scale of 1 to 10? Cause, you know, it could have been bad, but then we worked through it. And again, I think this is something that attachment teaches us. One of the great lessons of attachment is bound up with the care and the suffering and the challenge and the difficulty and the blood, sweat, and tears. That is what makes it meaningful. Frankl's got this metaphor of kind of the arch, and one way to strengthen an arch made of stones all around is to actually put more weight on it, to put more pressure on it. And that's a metaphor I think a lot about. I mean, Frankl was so gifted with metaphors, and climbing metaphors are spectacular, but that arch in particular, the notion of, I think there is this tendency to think, God, I had a bad afternoon. I need to take the day off. You know, I'm struggling right now. I need to do less. And sometimes that is absolutely the case. But sometimes the problem is we just don't have enough meaning in our life. We don't have enough to work hard for. We need to strengthen the arch by putting more weight upon it, by asking something even harder. And again, that's not a universal tactic, but I think when we always default to, I'm struggling, I need to do less, we end up realizing the goal here is not the absence of struggle. The goal here is meaning. And chase what gives you meaning. Don't just chase the absence of struggle.
No, I definitely agree. And I remember reading Man's Search for Meaning, and a particular phrase that came out to me and spoke to me was finding meaning is struggling and striving towards a worthwhile goal that you've chosen. That's what his definition of the meaning of life or his life was. Yeah. I remember when I was reading that, that was a period in summer last year when I hadn't started the podcast, I hadn't been doing as much photography. A few things had happened in friends, families that were quite tragic, and I was ill and I was doing less.
Yeah.
And I was very, very miserable in comparison to when I'm type A working on the podcast every single day.
Look, that's a perfect example of it. 100%.
Yeah. And another massive cliche would be, what's that one about diamonds and pressure? You know, diamonds can only form under the pressure.
Totally. I mean, who knew the theme of this podcast would be cliches? Virtue of cliches. But yeah, that's another great one.
Yeah. And can we talk a bit about memory? So is your recent book on memory, or are you creating a new one on memory?
That's a book I'm working on now. My most recent book was about mystery and kind of the pleasures of mystery, why we're drawn to the unknown, which is a very unique human predilection. And I was fascinated by it. Mostly, it kind of began with literature, like this notion, Stephen Greenblatt's notion of Shakespeare. His gift was what Greenblatt calls strategic opacity, the idea that Shakespeare would adapt a plot like Hamlet. And the reason we read Shakespeare's Hamlet and not Hamnet, the 14th century Dutch parable, is because Shakespeare made him mysterious. He made Hamlet this opaque character. He took away the obvious motivations. And the notion that intrinsic to all great literature, all great art, really things we're interested in, is this notion of opacity and mystery and difficulty. That's what keeps us coming back to them. Whether it's Harry Potter or the Bible, what makes them replayable, what makes them unspoilable, is this notion of layers. And there's something fundamentally unknowable about Hamlet and Snape and Moses and God. So that's what I was interested in, that book. The book I'm working on now, and I'm not close to finishing, it's a collaboration with a dear friend who's a scientist who studied how we remember. And from a neuroscientific perspective, the paradox of long-term memory has always been, you know, the half-life of a brain protein is typically 1 to 2 days. So our brain's like the ship of Theseus, right? It's always falling apart and being rebuilt. But so then how do our memories endure for years and decades, you know, a lifetime? And the scientist has discovered, so that's been a longstanding paradox. People have thought about it. Francis Crick has a beautiful short letter in Nature kind of remarking on this. So we have to find what he called a synaptic marker, something that marks a synapse that can stick around. And he had all sorts of theories for what it could be, none of which turned out to be true. The scientist I'm writing this book with has found the protein that marks these synapses, and it's a prion-like protein. So it actually changes shape and becomes virtually indestructible.
Wow.
And marks a synapse. And it's a very specific type of protein. What I've enjoyed about the book is it's technical in a way I've never really written before. So it's really kind of trying to make tertiary protein structure understandable and exciting to people. And so that's been a really fun kind of technical challenge as a writer. But it also raises all sorts of profound issues about memory and enhancing memory. A lot of big ideas fall out of this. Obviously, you know, we have Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and all these neurodegenerative diseases, which are truly afflictions of the 21st century, because we live longer.
Yeah.
They become much more common. And they seem to be related to proteins changing shape in the brain, which seem to be fundamental for human long-term memory. I think there are some suggestive insights into the human brain may express more of this protein that marks long-term memories. And maybe that helps explain kind of our gifts for language why we're capable of inventing the information age. So there are a lot of big ideas that fall out of this one protein and its structural implications. So it's been a super fun. It's been like such a blessing to write. I love working on it so much, but it's definitely been the hardest book I've ever written and will take the longest amount of time.
Well, I'm excited to read it, Jonah. And what's the key insight or story or example from the book so far that's really just stuck with you and really helps explain what you're trying to uncover and study?
I mean, there's lots of technical stuff that I find very interesting about the nature of protein shape. You know, we've always assumed proteins take on one shape. It's what's called the central dogma. You know, you have got your DNA becomes an mRNA, and then that codes a protein, and thermodynamics takes care of the rest. And turns out that's often not the case. But the one idea that I think about a lot. So if you know that long-term memory is defined by this protein that marks your synapses, then you can say, well, can we increase the amount of this protein in the right conformation? And one way to do that is by increasing the amount of proteins called chaperones that help this protein fold. So it's more likely that every short-term memory becomes a long-term memory. And you can do this in various animal models. And what you discover is that, yes, they can develop what seems like a kind of what we call a photographic memory. They become mnemonic machines. They remember everything.
Wow.
And you ask, well, that's kind of awesome. That's like limitless. Is that always a good thing? And what you discover is that no, on a lot of these learning paradigms, remembering too much is a kind of curse, right? Because you lose the ability to parse signal from noise. When you cannot remember everything, there's infinite noise. The world is a noisy, noisy place, and it becomes harder to detect the correlations that actually matter, you know? So instead of just paying attention to the bell that predicts the food, you start noticing the lights flicker and the scientist just sneezing. And this poor mouse with the perfect memory can perform as well as the dumb cousin who doesn't have photographic memory. So I've been thinking a lot about the nature of memory. And of course, you know, A.R. Luria's phenomenal case study, The Mind of a Mnemonist, where he studied a real life version of this and showed that this man with the perfect memory lived a very difficult life, like couldn't understand poetry, kind of lived inside these cinematic moments of childhood that he couldn't forget and couldn't generalize from. So I've been thinking a lot about the notion of memory and how evolution has set our threshold for long-term memory. And, you know, yes, I'd probably say, in the information, we evolved a threshold for setting long-term memories that wasn't the information age, in which we didn't have to remember endless amounts of discrete facts, which we didn't have language. So yes, we could probably use a little more long-term memory, especially as we get older.
Yeah.
But this long goal we've always had of, oh, I want to map that memory, that's almost certainly a curse.
Definitely. So it's always be careful what you wish for, isn't it?
Yes. Well, evolution has, you know, it's trade-offs all the way down, man.
Yeah.
And it has explored those trade-offs in lots of different parallel lives. So we come along with our myopic thinkings and who doesn't want a perfect memory without realizing that evolution has already played around with that and realized, no, you don't want a perfect memory.
And imagine if everyone had a perfect memory and those who'd gone through genuine trauma remembers that in vivid detail. It's hell.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
100%. I'm grateful for amnesia and all day, every day.
Yeah. And what are some of your favorite mysteries that haven't been solved yet?
Oh my goodness. I mean, I feel like Netflix has made documentaries about most of them at this point. I mean, favorite mysteries, this is a cop-out, but it's got to be consciousness, right? Probably the mystery of consciousness. How does a trillion neurons, plus or minus, firing little bursts of electricity create the feeling of this here now? That is a miracle any way you think about it. And it's a miracle that's fully intrinsic to every moment of our experience, just makes it even cooler. And the fact that even if science was able to solve this miracle and say, actually, it's just, this is a theory they used to have, it's 40 hertz oscillations from the medial prefrontal cortex. That's consciousness. Even if it's able to explain it, it still won't explain anything that are, because we don't experience 40 hertz oscillations or, you know, squirts of neurotransmitter being passed back and forth across a membrane. That is the fact that our experience is such an emergent property from this piece of 3 pounds of bloody meat inside our skull. To me, that is the ultimate mystery. And, I don't know how I keep coming back to it. It is a mystery we will never be able to explain, right? Mm-hmm. Just because that's the bounded nature of our brain. We weren't meant to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So this notion that we can look in the mirror and never understand the essence of our experience, even if one day neuroscience is able to give us a coherent, compelling explanation for here are the wires that produce consciousness, that is still not our experience of it. To me, that is the most fascinating epistemic gap. And that's why we'll always need art and religion and all the rest, right? We'll always need these levels of explanation that speak to experience as it exists, not experience as, you know, as it emerges from a piece of meat.
So you think we'll never be able to fully explain consciousness?
No, I mean hypothetically, I think science could one day explain. It's a fascinating mystery because in many respects we've gotten farther away from it, right? I think my read of the consciousness literature is several decades ago, we were more confident that we would be able to explain it than we are now. You had people talking about the neurocorrelates of consciousness. You had bold explanations involving quantum physics. There were all sorts of theories out there. Now, I don't think we really even have theories about it. So in some respects, it's one of those fascinating moments of scientific history where as we've learned more and more about the brain, we've gotten farther away from even trying to make conjectures about consciousness. Now, one day we absolutely may be able to solve it. I don't see why it's not a tractable scientific question. My point is that even if science was able to solve it, we wouldn't be able to understand how that mapped onto our experience, you know, phenomenologically. I'm butchering that word, but it still wouldn't explain, well, why don't I feel like a trillion neurons firing small bits of electricity? Why do I feel like me? Why does it feel like this? The texture of experience, the juiciness of a peach is not just some sensory areas going off. It's an experience. So that's what I'm trying to get at. We'd still need levels of explanation that speak to experience as it is. And that's, we'd still need novels. We'd still need movies. We'd still need the Bible. We'd still need poetry. We'd still need all that stuff, because even if neuroscience was able to solve this problem, it wouldn't be a solution.
It seems like even if we're able to solve and explain it, we won't be able to understand it, at least intuitively, just from first principle, right?
Yeah.
And there might be probably an evolutionary reason why that's the case, right?
Yeah. Look, the brain is a bounded machine, and we still may end up feeling like the best description of conscious experience may be to the lighthouse. It may be a novel. It may be a movie. It almost certainly won't be the most accurate representation to us. May not be the scientific theory, if it ever exists. It may be to the lighthouse.
Do you think that's a reason why we're trying to create super intelligent AI, just from a even maybe unconscious reason? Like, we have this unconscious desire to just continue to improve and understand more and more, and a big driver to create something that's more intelligent than us is to explain ourselves and our suffering.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think certainly, I think the question of meaning and loneliness and all these existential questions about why we're here, we've always been asking those questions. I mean, that's why religion exists, right? It's why we've had philosophers. It's why we write novels. They've all been attempts to wrestle with these, the most wicked problems. I don't know if that's the exact motivation for superintelligent AI, but it's certainly how people will use it. I mean, we will, there will be people who, I'm sure ChatGPT is a very well-versed answer for why am I here? Whether or not an LLM will be able to solve it, that's way above my pay grade. I tend to be very skeptical of that. But that's mostly because I don't think there are solutions, right? And that gets back to the notion of mystery and learning to live with mystery and the notion that the works of art that stick around, that survive, are not the ones that give us answers. They're the ones that give us questions. And I think that's the fundamental misreading of, say, the Bible, is we turn to the Bible for answers. But the reason the Bible still exists as a document is because it's so full of ambiguity and so full of rich literary questions. And there's tremendous meaning in those questions. So maybe I'm incredibly naive and maybe, you know, a super intelligent AI will reveal the triteness of all these mysteries. Color me skeptical.
Yeah. And I think mystery and things that aren't solvable creates a drive and a will to live in humans. I think hell would be knowing everything, maybe.
Yeah. Certainly, I think some of our most elevated emotions, the question of awe.
Mm-hmm.
Awe is the experience of mystery. Awe is not the experience of personal, you know, rational understanding. Awe is the experience of something sublime beyond me that I don't even know what to ask. That is and awe is a lot of the greatest moments of life. And that is so bound up with the notion of mystery and not knowing. And of course, now we have all these interactive tools, whether it's ChatGPT, whether it's Google, that never say, I don't know. Like, part of their comfort is their inability to accept mystery. Google will not return a query. And that's what makes it so useful. But at the same time, there is this, and that's part of the reason I want to write a book about mystery. There's this fundamental yearning for the unknown. And again, what sticks around, if you look at culture, what sticks around, what lasts, the test is time. What survives is not stuff that gives us answers. It is stuff that gives us perpetual questions that they are question machines, you know? You understand less about Hamlet the 10th time you read it than you did the first time. Just at a fundamental level, it's like the question of, is art spoilable tells you how great it is. If you can spoil it by telling me the ending, probably wasn't great. But if you can, you know, when Shakespeare writes all's well that ends well, he knows I created something spoiler proof, man. Like, I tell you how it's going to end and it doesn't matter. It's still a great play. You know, everyone who saw Hamlet knew it was a tragedy and it didn't matter because it wasn't that good. It was so full of mystery. So that is what lasts. And I do think, you know, at the most general possible level of culture, I think our tolerance for mystery has been reduced because now we live in the age of machines that just give us answers.
Yeah, it's very true. And if you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be and why?
You know, it's a great question. I should probably say I'll get back to you on that. But the answer that comes to mind first, and I think is probably the most truthful one, is to tell him to focus on what he loves. Focus on the act of doing it. Love is manual labor, right? Love is not the fruits of it. Love is the act of doing it. To focus on doing it and loving the process, not the end, but the means. And if you do that, you'll be okay.
Mm. Jonah Lehrer, ladies and gentlemen. Jonah, really, really appreciate this.
So fun. Thank you so much. That was a total pleasure.
I love the vibe of spontaneity, you know, going down different tangents and coming back to things and circling back. And you've helped make that happen in this episode. So I really appreciate it. It doesn't always happen, but when it does, I love it. So thank you so much. And what are you currently working on? Where can people find it?
What I'm currently working on is this book about memory and the peculiar molecular foundations. Know where to find it. Hopefully it's out in the next couple of years, but we'll see.
What about your other pieces of work? Where can people go if they want to find that?
Well, Mystery, that book came out a few years ago. That's where all books are sold. And then you can just search my name on Amazon and you'll see my first book, Priest was a Neuroscientist and How We Decide and Imagine. I just wanted to thank you for the conversation. I really enjoyed this. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure. And I'd love to have you come back on in the future.
Anytime.
Awesome. If you've made it this far, you're likely not just a listener. You're ready to be the host. You felt that sense of intimacy and connection with our guest today, and you would like to get the same on your own show and start your own dream show. But you're worried about landing dream guests and all the complications and the mess that is often spoken about when starting your own podcast from scratch. You think starting a podcast requires a huge budget and a whole team, right? That is absolute nonsense. My Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is the ultimate key to skipping the outdated advice and building a high quality, high impact show, even for under $100. It provides the proven strategies and AI templates that I use this day that you will be able to use to reclaim your time and creative control. And this is a strictly limited opportunity. Don't dilly-dally because there's limited spaces. We've already got one student, Rob, who's joined. That means there's only a couple more spaces to get the Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint course half price. And you need to act very, very fast because this is a limited offer and you're very, very early. So if you want to get the early bird discount like Rob has and get the results by watching the course that goes through the exact step-by-step blueprint that I use to this day to create these episodes that you've just watched and get the success and become Europe's fastest growing under 21 podcaster, and also join live weekly calls with me and use the AI templates and email templates that I use every single day to get the results and just get all my secrets without getting any of the mistakes and failures that I've made, then top link in the description is for you. And if you're ready to launch your own show and get personalized one-to-one help from me and copy my blueprint, which no other podcaster has shared, then I'll see you there. I'm rooting for you. Goodbye. Hope you enjoyed the episode too.